the topic of each week we have, I'm Chris Sheridan. How do you like that, Beth?
Hi, Chris.
Every week we regather in this place, trying to raise up an issue that matters in our lives more broadly beyond the village. Part of the mission of Holden Village is to equip us to go out and serve in the world. Certainly, we equip each other with hilarity and foolishness, but also we try and equip each other with strategic thinking. The ideas that we encounter here, the ways of engaging faith and life that we encounter here, have to have legs once we leave the village, or they'll just remain nice ideas we heard about at Holden and not realities in our lives. And the forums are an opportunity for us to talk together about how we give these ideas legs. How do we make these things we encounter matter in the face of our social life, our society beyond here? And today, we just heard a powerful sermon, and we've engaged in a powerful idea, reflection and action on a powerful idea today, Jubilee. So we came up with this community forum. Should we really declare this radical message of Jubilee as a Christian community? Do we dare? What does this mean in the context of our global economy? And we happen to have this week on our teaching staff a business professor and an economics professor who can get our conversation started in thinking strategically about how can we make connections from this ancient and radical and maybe never enacted practice, prophetic practice in our lives today. Well, I'm a theologian, going to teach worship at Luther Seminary, and one of the things I'd like to throw into the mix as we begin the conversation is we just enacted it in the social ordering, the economy of worship. When all are fed, all have enough, all gather around singing and praying and sharing in a call and response process in which we lift our lives before God and God offers to us mercy and love. That social ordering is pretty difficult to translate directly into how we go to work at our jobs and how we go to shop at Walmart or Kmart or Target or Nordstrom. But that's the kind of stuff we want to get at tonight. So John and Kit are going to offer a few snappy, provocative, agitational comments to get us going. How's that for an
agitation?
Or slow.
Yeah, I'm a dismal scientist, so I'm like snappy.
You want to start off, Mr. Bright Eyes?
To get a conversation going. once they've had their moment of glory, their moment in the sun, that all of you have your moment in the sun.
That's right.
Because the form is only as good as all of us. So let's get into it.
Okay, so I was reading Harry Potter. I usually read it in the summertime. And this afternoon, after I slept through the auction, and there's this. This is the very last book, and I don't know if you've read Harry Potter, but there's a goblin, and the goblins are craftsmen. They're also the bankers. Okay, so Harry Potter has this sword, and he makes a deal with a goblin who works at the bank to help him break into the bank to get something they need to get. And there's a bunch of symbolism there in the book, but and it connects the story. But Harry's one of his friends tells him that he doesn't understand how goblins think about things. And the goblin makes a deal that if the goblin, Harry's name is Riphook, helps Harry get into the bank, that Harry will give him the sword that's a goblin-made sword. And so Harry's talking to Bill, and Bill says, there's a belief among goblins that wizards cannot be trusted in matters of gold and treasure, that they have no respect for goblin ownership. I respect Harry began, but Bill shook his head. No. You don't understand, Harry. Nobody can understand unless they've lived with goblins. To a goblin, the rightful and true master of any subject is the maker, not the purchaser. All goblin-made objects are, in goblin eyes, rightfully theirs. and they would consider it rented by the one who had paid the money to buy it. They have, however, great difficulty with the idea of goblin-made objects passing from wizard to wizard. You saw Griphook's face when the tiara passed under his eyes. This was another goblin-made thing. He disapproves. I believe Griphook thinks, as do the fiercest of his kind, that everything they made ought to have been returned to the goblins once the original purchaser died. They consider our habit of keeping goblin-made objects, passing them from wizard to wizard without further payment, a little more than theft. So, part of the Jubilee message, and there's the verse that at the very beginning where it says, all the land belongs to the Lord, you're all aliens and tenants. Mm-hmm. It's very much a goblin view of the world. Okay. And so we need to, I think one of the things we want to think about is this a, what is that system? What would living in that kind of system mean? And in fact, when you read Leviticus 25, and you've heard it, or I hope, you know, if you have a chance to read it, there's this talk about redemption. And so the 50-year point, so there's these 6 years of crops and the seventh year of fallow. And then there's seven cycles of 7 years is 49 years, and the 50th year, then everything's fallow again. And in the Jubilee, debts will be forgiven, land will be returned to their owners. Okay, and when you read it, you go, who owns it? You know, who are we talking about reversion to or redemption from? You know, who are the goblins in this text? So I spent my afternoon doing research. And so this was from, it turns out there's an Israeli law journal that has a bunch of stuff on biblical land law. And there's a journal of law and religion, which also has some stuff on this. And so this is a guy named Raymond Westerbrook writes, our verdict, therefore, on the biblical law of the Jubilee is that while its basic idea of a release reflects a practical and practiced institution, and that this business about redemption is part of Jewish law and land law, but the part thereof which is academic and theoretical is the stipulation of its regular recurrence every 50 years. This conclusion throws light on the biblical legislature's method of work. That is, there's some consensus among the scholars that this piece of Leviticus is really theoretical. And it reflects the fact in Jewish land law that land was in part kind of tribal and family, and that they wanted to keep land within families. So they did practice a form of redemption, which is if you sold your land, somebody, you could go back and redeem it. That is, you could go back and buy it from the buyer. And if you read this, that, you know, how far away are you from the 50 years? What's the price you have to pay? Or if a Lund bought a piece of land, a Hinderly could go redeem it. Kind of, you know, there's family connections here. And that in fact, was part of the way this land worked. So that it was kind of goblin land. And the goblins were not God. And since it's all goblins, they were families tied into the tribes. Okay? And what that means then is there were actually ways to inherit land and to pass, devise land by will. Numbers 25 has this thing about what do you do if you die without a will? Of land goes to your eldest son, then to your daughters, then to your brother, then to your, you know, that's called intestacy. When you die without an estate, how does your property get divided up if you haven't said anything about it? But you could clearly pass your land on through a kind of will, which means that and there's no mention of that in Leviticus, right? But there would have to be. This was actually happening. Because the 50 years, who does that apply to? Does it apply to the original guy who sold it or the person? Yeah. You know, right. What happens if you get it from your dad and then the guy, you know, all that kind of stuff. I was hoping I'd find out more about it, and what I found out was less about it. In a way, I mean, this, you know, I, as an economist, I would be fascinated by a system in which every 50 years, all the land reverted back to an original set of individuals, because you would expect to see, like mortgages, like we were talking about this afternoon, mortgages would cease to exist in the last 10 years. Okay, like, nobody, what would you borrow on something that's, you know, that you can't get any security on, and there would be a bunch of interesting kind of patterns there. But I think really what this is reflecting is more goblin world, where there are in fact this kind of notion of collective ownership of land that as Yahweh is attributed to in Leviticus, that they want to create security in land, right? And so they're securing it in a kind of communal way. And so this ability to redeem things then becomes part of the security of land in a larger social unit and perhaps less security of land for an individual. You know, so if I buy and sell, if I really want to buy land from another family, then I'm going to go to pretty great lengths to make sure that I've extinguished their rights to redeem it. Mm-hmm. And as you, there's the thing about the land in the walled towns, it's going to be sold in perpetuity and not redeemed in the Jubilee. But that then reflects that there are plenty of circumstances in which individuals can transfer land outside of families under certain arrangements which couldn't be redeemed. There are lots of places in the world that have not really well-defined individual property rights in land. And those places have trouble working in terms of having a market for land. It's mortgage stuff and the things we were talking about. So there's, you know, the use of land to provide for the poor in the kind of way that the Leviticus talks about is a possibility. That would be one that would probably be relatively expensive for society as a whole. And it would make land a whole lot harder to buy and sell and move around to higher value uses and use. Anyway, that's what I learned this afternoon.
Did they really buy and sell land, or did they rent the land, if you will, period? As I recall, and I can help me out on this, wasn't it divided up among the 12 tribes,
right.
And each tribe had its piece, and then one of the tribes got the cities, so they got their land, and then they had use of the land for the 50 years. Now, what I take on it is, I just put some numbers on it. After 25, if the land, will say, was worth $100, after 25 years, it'd be worth $50, kind of a rental.
Right.
Toward the end.
Yeah.
So at the end of the 50 years, it goes back to
the
original family.
Right. So that's why I read that one sentence from the Westbrook piece. Because what he argues, and he actually has a book about Jewish land law, which is not in the library, but I'm sure it's in a library somewhere. He said this: the 50-year thing is the fiction. Okay? The redemption part's real.
That whole redemption business, as you've described it, seems the very opposite of Jubilee as we've just been celebrating it in terms of redistribution.
Right.
You're perpetuating the aristocracy, if you will.
Yeah. Well, even if you think of the Jubilee, how it would work, okay? And there's talk about taking care of the poor, and you know you're forcing to sell your land because you run out of money, so you need to do a debt. But with the exception of that, all of the land is going back to the people who originally owned it.
The land
probably wasn't poor people,
yeah.
Right? I mean, so that you have this sort of recurring pattern of ownership that you can't, you know.
If you think about it as this group of people who came out of Egypt, in which they owned Zippo, Pharaoh had oppressed them, had worried about their numbers, and had made them slaves. And they owned nothing. And they come out of Egypt into this promised land, and each of the 12 tribes gets a plot of land. So one of the things they learned, if you think about their experience in the wilderness, they were in the wilderness for more than a generation. Enough time to unlearn some of the habits of Egypt and to relearn some new patterns, partly taught by how they were provided for. They were provided enough for every day. Manna and quails. And if they hoarded more than enough for a day, it rotted. It got worms and rotted. And so there's this alternative pattern, much more much more egalitarian than Egypt, where they were on the very bottom. And they go into the land of Canaan, and they have this distributed tribal system with judges before they got a king, before they got a monarchy. And if this Jubilee section was really written in exile or around that time, then it could have been an idealistic proposal of how they could recover the nature of their early social and economic patterns.
If they had been the victims of exploitation somehow, why would they have lost it?
Well, because they got a monarchy. They said, we want a king like other nations. And so then all of a sudden they had taxes, they had an army, they had a whole sort of court nobility. I mean, read about King Solomon. The dude had money coming out of his ears. He had...
They're getting it back from the king.
Well, reorganizing their social structure from one that looked a whole lot like Egypt, actually. And like Assyria, and like Babylon.
Because Leviticus is set like a couple years after they're into the wilderness. They're not about to go into the promised land. They've just barely got the laws. Now you've got a whole bunch of slaves. How are we supposed to live?
Right.
I remember the story. My folks went to Liberia, West Africa, as missionaries. And one of the tragic stories of Liberia is that former slaves from the United States went back to Liberia and formed a slavehood of the native Liberians, in which they were the slave owners, because that was the only system that they knew. And so these freed slaves, God has to give them to say something. It's going to be different. It's going to be more like this. And this is 40 years before there's any land ownership whatsoever. But it's going to be more like this, where you're going to have some land, but you're not going to have it because it's, you know, it's going to be different from Egypt.
Don't the prophets, you know, the latter prophets were proclaiming, woe to you that add one field onto another, with the idea that, well, if you, a person can only farm so much land, so if you have more than, you have to have tenants. And so if that's going on, the Levitical story of Jubilee is a reaction, is a response to that position that the prophets were already condemning before the exile.
You got to be really careful, though, because if you read it, a whole lot of the Jubilee is not about land, it's about labor. Uh-huh. And it's about hired labor, bound labor, which is what we would call an indenture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they're not slaves in the sense that they're owned, although, you know, they talk about not being harsh. So that in fact, is perfectly legit there to have lots of hired labor. And in fact, part of the rules are about who, when they fall into the status of hired labor, or a bound, you know, where they sell themselves into indentures. So they, you know, many people came to America by selling themselves into a period of bound labor in America in return for paying their boat fare.
Right.
That's clearly going on, and that's part of the poverty. What happens when somebody falls into that? How do you redeem that? And there are other places, you know, I'm way over my head, you know, so don't think I know what I'm talking about. In Jeremiah and Ruth, where they're talking about how they buy and sell land, okay? And so there is clearly a discussion about the possibility of putting pieces together that individuals and families could do. The context here is that this is not the structure is still one of a kind of tribal family orientation, and the laws are set up to make that relatively easier, but that doesn't mean that you've got equal distribution within the family.
Right,
you're going to have a network of landowners that are tied together, and that insecurity for an individual produces, I think that's a big part of this, having social units which are tied to the land. I mean, you know, but they can't buy and sell land. They probably don't buy and sell land a lot, and they identify the ownership of land with larger units rather than individuals.
One way I think about this is it's like limit systems,
mm-hmm. Right?
What is it limiting? It's limiting maximal dehumanization or oppression of certain people within your society, like they experienced in Egypt.
Right.
There's this continual recalling of, you know, do this because remember,
mm-hmm. Once you were slaves, and now you're not.
Yeah, exactly. So that makes me raise the question, and I think I want at least Kit to
comments on
Could
it.
Could you say other, something provocative,
other
please?
Too. What? How do those kinds of limit claims function for us today? And does the Jubilee call us to a heightened awareness of certain ways of limiting maximal advantage over against people who we can gain advantage over against them? Whether it's people in third world countries who are making our Nikes, or whether it's the chicken floor workers in Arkansas who are slaughtering our chickens for the grocery store. There you go.
I'll say something provocative. my world is sort of an international institutional world, and so the question comes up, of debt service overseas and forgiving of debts. Mm-hmm. It's interesting in Chinese tradition, and I lived a while in Taiwan, you're supposed to have settled all your debts by the end of the year. Mm. And people really try and do that. It's interesting, though, that right before Chinese New Year, the crime rate in Taipei just skyrockets. Okay. So everybody's stealing from everybody else so they can clear it. They're dead. I think, just to be provocative, I'd like to say that there are, within international institutions, we've got the World Bank and we've got the IMF, and in some circles you say those names and you can already hear the imperialist running dog, oppressors. Both John and I know people that work in those institutions, and those institutions were formed after World War II. Why? Because the world was a shambles, and the world needed to come together as a collective to help each other out and to rebuild what was a absolutely devastated world economy. And so, who is the IMF? The IMF is us. Okay, the IMF is made up of all the major economies of the world. Everybody pays into the IMF, into a fund. It has its own currency called the Special Drawing Right, SDR. And when countries get into trouble, the IMF lends them money, okay? And they repay that money. That's your money, okay? Do you? And so it's kind of an interesting thing where, in the late 90s, there was this thing called the Asian contagion. And where there's a currency manipulation in Thailand and moved around, and major economies in Asia were crashing. And a lot of speculation and a lot of reasons. We're not here to teach economics, but it's not. But a lot of issues were happening. And the IMF came in, and South Korea was on its knees, it was broken. The IMF came in. And to the country, basically recapitalized the country. Okay. And South Korea promptly, within a few years, actually ahead of schedule, there was a repayment schedule, they paid it back. Okay. Mexico's done the same thing. They got in trouble, they paid it back. Now, this thing falls apart if we say we're not a collective, and Thailand and Malaysia and South Korea, you folks are on your own. You can wait 10 or 15 years in a depression. You can reflate your own economy. Okay. Now, we have a vested interest in those economies not being broken, so it's not totally altruistic. But this is a collective of the international system that's lending money and expects to get the money repaid. Okay. Now, the knock on the IMF is, governments have got a, whatever the reason, whether it was exterior or interior, but oftentimes it's mismanagement on the interior. Everybody hires their own people. They have state-owned enterprise that's protected. And you have 6,000 people in a factory doing the work of, 1,400. Okay, so the IMF goes in and says, you've got to change your economy. You've got to shrink your state-owned enterprises, your SOEs. And if you do that, we believe you're going to get back on your feet. Okay? and we'll lend you the money. The country has the option. They can say, yes, we'll take the money, or we'll take the money. Free will. If they take the money, you know, it's like a mortgage. You have to live within the terms of that mortgage. Every month you got to do something. So it's a very complicated world we live in, but sort of coming back to this Jubilee piece, this is the IMF, which is a World Bank, which is us, is a collective. And if we come around and say, you know, we won't lend you money. You can stay in a depression 15 years and reinflate your way out, or we can help you, but you have to repay us back. Final comment is there's a classification of very poor countries that have been given loans by the World Bank, and they have not paid them back, and they, in a sense, have been forgiven those loans. And in many places, once those loans are forgiven, from a banking point of view, they're no longer risk, so you'll loan them more. And it's a category called HIPC, heavily indebted poor countries. This is not where you want to be. And this is the Hondurans, and this is Guyana, South America, which I know something about. And it's a very complicated question. The major institutions have forgiven debt, continue to forgive debt, but the intent is that everybody in the family of nations, again, this is sort of nice speak, but everybody benefits when everybody is whole and comes together. And that's the foundation of the World Bank and the IMF.
Does the membership in IMF change? Are Brazil, India, Russia, China members? They were from the beginning?
Pretty much from the beginning. Right after World War II, all the major economies became...
Including, at that time, China,
I'm not sure
India?
When China came.
China may or may not.
China may not have been at the beginning.
The World Bank's clients, the World Bank doesn't lend to countries above a certain income level, which is...
Well, my question is, you've got rising economies now. Are they in the pot,
funding
money?
The fund's for everybody. So Germany can borrow from the fund.
No, but he's saying, are we paying?
Isn't Germany an IMF country?
Yeah, no. So there's money in... The IMF is a bank.
Yeah.
Essentially.
The resources come from the big economies. My question is...
No, they kind of do, but they actually... It's the bank itself. There's a bunch of, I mean, people contributed to start it, okay?
But all, as investments?
Yeah. And so the bank is supposed to make, the IMF is supposed to make money, and does. In fact, it's having trouble right now, because a bunch of the countries don't want to borrow from it. Because they don't want to borrow from it, they don't have anybody to loan to, because they can only loan to countries, and their income's going down. The World Bank's different. The World Bank is a pool of money that people contribute to, so the United States and other countries, developed countries, actually give the World Bank money every year. And the World Bank's clients, it's called the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, that's its formal name. Those clients are only poor countries, and they basically make investments in infrastructure and finance and that sort of thing. So the IMF's a little bit different, but it's intended, like Kit said, the IMF is intended to provide countries that are having current problems, short-term problems, with a way to solve those problems. Get over these short-term liquidity crises. That
so taxpayer government money doesn't fund the World Bank. Individual investors for profit fund the bank. Is that what you're saying?
No. Taxpayer money from the United States does go to the World Bank.
Okay.
Not to the IMF, pretty much. The IMF is a fund. It's called an International Monetary Fund that everybody contributed to a long time ago. And then it's a bank. It's not for profit. If it makes profit, it just has that money and it uses it to lend out to other people.
So then why do people go, when you say this? What was that comment about?
Do you think they're tools of a kind of global capitalist conspiracy to globalize the economy and make poor people poorer?
Oh, why? Why do they think that?
Because we're naturally suspicious and cynical.
Well, something that Kit said was that the IMF has been, generally speaking, against state enterprise, which has tended to be oriented towards Marxist or socialist-leaning governments, and so there's been a perceived... capitalist, Western democratic leaning in the policies of the bank, and many progressives in the U.S. and Europe have been really supportive of revolutionary countries like Cuba, like Nicaragua, like Chile, and those efforts have been opposed oftentimes by our government. And so then by this sort of guilt by association, that the IMF must be like this sort of global right-wing conspiracy that runs our government and runs the IMF and puts down these people's revolutions trying to sort of democratize the economy in these countries. And that sort of, you know, there's some truth in that, but there's also some truth, I think, in this sense that, you know, partly the economies are doing badly because they're so bloated with efforts to employ everybody. And so I think the truth is somewhere in the mix, but I think that dynamic has contributed to, political leftists
right.
complaining really loudly about the...
Well, it wouldn't make you very happy if you said that there are 6,000 people or 3,000 workers doing a job of 1,400, so the bank says, you know, you cut your employee staff to 1,400, all those other people just got laid off. Yeah. That would not make you happy.
They're not happy, but the point is that the government, you know, it's the government is so inefficient that it's using its very limited resources in a hugely inefficient way. So it's taxing and being a burden on the economy and taking those resources from the economy and putting them to absolutely inefficient use. So why not take those, you know, government receipts and build a port, you know, build some infrastructure, you know, build some roads, which, going back to Adam Smith, if you have access to the world markets, that's what's going to grow your economy, not staying isolated, you know, in some socialist heaven, you know, with high tariffs to protect this inherently inefficient industry.
But if you're the guy that got laid off,
you're not going to be happy.
You're not going to be happy, which is why people might not like it.
Well, the governments don't want to lay anybody off.
Let's go back here. Let's generally try to hear our thoughts, jump in and share what you're thinking.
Just a quick response to the why people don't really like the IMF or the World Bank. Another aspect is that sometimes poor countries, such as many countries in South America, get loans, and the top people in their government takes the money and uses it how they will, and not really to rebuild the government or their economy or their society. And then that country is still later, when that person may or may not be in power, that country is made to repay, but in their made to repay this money that they never saw. And in doing that and not using it ever for their own economy or their own society, they're stuck in the cycle of poverty.
So this is a true story. In 1837, Michigan borrowed $5 million. And they issued the bonds. We're not there anymore. To a bank, and it's called the Morris Canal and Banking Company in New Jersey, near New York. And the Morris Canal Company promised to pay them roughly $1 million a year for the next 5 years. And after a couple of years, the Morris Company defaulted on them. And so the state of Michigan said, we're never going to pay the bonds that we issued that we never got paid back for, we're never going to pay them back. Okay? Which was exactly the kind of the logic there. Mississippi did the same thing. Arkansas, Florida repudiated some of their debts. Okay? And as a result of that process, not just those, there were some other states that defaulted, the states changed the way they borrowed. And so that they would make better decisions about how much they were going to borrow. And you know, you've all voted. If you voted, you probably voted for a school referendum or something. You authorize your government to borrow money. Okay. And so one of the questions that was really alive 2 years ago at Jubilee was: should we forgive the high income, the high debt? What did they?
Heavily indebted
poor countries because of these things where the money went in, it was supposed to go in to build a railroad or a water system or whatever, and it all got skimmed off and went. That's what happened in Michigan. Somebody took the money, and the canal never showed up, right? And how do we think about making that not happen again, right? Mm-hmm. And then that becomes a real question, I think, IMF, World Bank, Jubilee, kinds of ideas. If we redeem those debts, then how do we get that country the next time it borrows to make sure that the money goes to the whatever? You know, how do we begin to, you know, it is, what are the, you know, what's the, not the one-time effect, but the long-term effect? How do we get those decisions made? And I think what, you know, Chris was saying earlier about limits. You know, the big part of this is about how do we, the intent here is not so much to regulate the credit markets and the land markets, I think it's to provide sort of this minimum safety net. In which the Jewish law has lots of things to say. You got to take care of widows, you got to take care of orphans, you got to take care of travelers, and that sort of thing. And those kind of issues, I think, are not quite so well addressed in the Jubilee, although they were nicely addressed by Ingrid, right? Mm-hmm. So, what are the mechanisms that we can think about for structuring our society to do it that way? And one of the, Jody was asking me last night because I was ruminating about Jubilee. Because I don't think the mechanisms that we identify in the Jubilee with the debt restrictions are the best way to do that. So is this important to think about? Yeah, because there's one-time problems like, should we redeem the debt? You know, should we forgive the debt for Ghana? You know, because the people in Ghana are having to pay taxes to service this debt for which they got nothing out of it. And that's, you know, on its own merits, the answer is, yeah, sure. You know, that's fine. I mean, I'll pay a dollar or whatever, and my tax burden has to be to do that. I don't have a problem doing that. The question then is, what happens next?
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know.
There's some really interesting experimentation going on around the requirements of countries which would be eligible for debt forgiveness,
right.
In which they have to show certain internal capacity building efforts, not only in terms of regulations that would show transparency in how their government works and accounting for money and so forth, but also their effort to tend to infrastructure issues, so that in a sense they're giving an advance promise by saying, see, we're already acting responsibly, so that if you forgive the debt, we're a good bet. We're going to take that extra revenue and we're going to invest it properly or not. So there's an organization that advocates for this kind of stuff called DATA, which is debt, AIDS, trade, and there's another A. Anybody know? Anyway, they have two acronyms for the name. One is what they organize for, debt relief and trade assistance, and the other is an accountability acronym about checking countries to make sure that they're meeting certain basic standards of accountability before debt forgiveness is offered. And the countries that have met that and have had debt forgiven are really inspiring examples of what can happen. So that makes me think about this question from Luke 4 about preaching good news to the poor. And thinking about, on the policy level, is this something Jesus would say yes to? Does this policy say good news to the poor? And if it's simply blind forgiveness to a country so that, you know, a despot can have a bank account in Switzerland, that's not good news to the poor. And so then it's a farce. The forgiveness isn't really Jubilee forgiveness. It's just waste. So that's an interesting question, I think. It's worth pondering. How do we think about social policy as good news to the poor? Yeah, Jody.
I'm sort of agnostic about the IMF and the World Bank. I think they're absolutely necessary institutions for the global economy at this point, and I agree with a lot of what you guys are saying about that. When I'm working in communities at the local level in Africa or Latin America, and you're looking up at the elephants who are boring up here, it doesn't look like that often. For example, a lot of the message from the World Bank in particular, I'm not sure as much about the IMF, to state governments, to state economies, national economies, is increase exports. That's good for your economy. What that means at the local level often is that farmers who have been used to subsistence farming, but farming that really does support the whole village, right? Because they rotate crops, they grow a lot of different stuff, they grow everything people want to need to eat, all of a sudden, all their land has to go over to coffee,
because that needs to be exported, and the state economy will benefit from that, which means that all of a sudden this village, which was, you know, was thriving, but it was feeding itself over centuries, right? All of a sudden it's impoverished, and it's dependent, and the economic ladder has been just sort of pulled out from under these folks. So I'm not as sanguine about what happens at the local level in a lot of developing countries when the policies of the World Bank sort of seep down through the elites and get down to where folks actually live.
There's a great book by a guy, a political scientist at Harvard named Robert Bates, called Markets and States in Tropical Africa. And he talks exactly about that process, but that turns out also to be an African process. That's an outcome of the dynamic of internal politics as well as what the World Bank's trying to do.
Sure.
Right, that you get, you're an agricultural economy. You know, Africa is plenty productive. It's got lots of agriculture, and it's starving to death.
That's right.
Yeah.
Some of Latin America, too.
Some of Latin America. But Africa's really just astonishingly bad at growing its own food.
Yeah.
Right? And so here you get, you want to promote economic development, and you've got political power in the cities, so you create marketing boards to encourage farmers to produce stuff that you can export, and you lower the price of farm products so farmers get screwed three ways, and then you put the political cronies in charge of the marketing boards, and then that becomes part of the internal structure of how Africa these states hold themselves together.
So would they be thriving more if they just were creating or growing their own crops? I mean, would that...
Well, they probably could solve the hunger problem.
I think so.
Right.
I mean, economic terms, you guys have to correct me here, but I think that sometimes the option is between increasing exports and doing what's called import substitution,
right,
where you don't import stuff any longer, but you find ways to substitute for what you would import produce it locally.
Oh, sure.
And that's a way to grow the economy,
right?
And it's a way that sort of defines itself from the local setting,
right? And is that possible for them to do that, given the political structure?
Well, that depends on the state.
And there's this guy, if you're talking about violence.
Yeah.
You know, and that turns out to be a big right. part of these things, is right. that they really have trouble because they got to keep these guys, it's not a matter of bad guys being in power, it's a matter of how do you keep these factions from fighting each other. Not only tribalism, there's this map of Africa that the Africans have decided to live with that was imposed on them, you know, somebody else drew it.
Right.
And so they have lots of places with lots of conflict. And they really had, that's a result of colonialism. It's not just a result of colonialism. They always had lots of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And so they use the economy to solve those political problems. And
back to your initial little chart about up and down. So the solution is political stability, individual freedom to stimulate growth internally. Yeah.
No, in fact, in the places in Africa that get stability, grow.
Yeah.
You know, the problem is that they shrink, too, because they're the guys at the bottom level of that table where they grow in roughly as many years as they shrink. And their shrinking is typically because of internal disruption, not because of a shock from the outside. You know, like we've seen in the last year, several places in Africa tearing themselves apart.
Listening to you kind of coming in thinking, okay, what would implementing Jubilee economics look
right.
like globally? What I'm kind of hearing is that in some ways, I mean, Leviticus 1, that the prevailing economic theory, anyway, is a rejection of Egyptian get everything you can and enslave and screw everybody else,
right.
but that there is an interest and a self-interest globally that says we're all better off if we all figure out some way to get along, and that involves some forgiveness of debt. It involves making sure nobody gets too much, making sure that the very bottom gets some kind of safety net. Is that a fair?
And also, like some governments are not very good, you know. And
sure, implementation.
And if there is a way to bring, you know, open them up to the world and get those. I'm thinking of a trip I took to Guyana, and we were looking at doing a project there. I went to see the Prime Minister. And this is a very socialist country. And behind him on a rack was the writings of Kim Il-sung. Okay. Now, who the hell are we taking our model from? You know, North Korea, which is pathetic, is that how we're going to replicate, you know, how is that how we're going to do good things in South America? It's not. So there has to be a gentle way of supporting not the Kim Il-sungs or the elites of the world, but to reinflate economies where it can work. And everybody benefits. If Guyana's economy and standard of living improves, everybody benefits. Because we'll trade with them, they'll trade with us. And just a final, Jerry's bang on the statism thing. And coffee is a very interesting one. It depends on the state. And you look at some states where import substitution is an effective thing. It really is. In some countries, let's say we can talk about Rwanda, we can talk about Jamaica. They don't drink coffee, but they use those as export spinners, and they are major sources of foreign revenue for Jamaica, and are one of the very few areas of growth in Rwanda. And the reason that's workable is that the state is sort of out of the mix. There's not this state marketing board. The profits are not going to the cities and screwing the farmers. They're selling directly to Starbucks. And so they're getting their $3.50 and $4.50 per pound, which is a huge price on the world market. So coffee is a colonial crop, and yet in some depends upon where it works and it works. And finally, you talk about governments and violence, and Jody's point when he talked about having a civil society that works. Look at Zimbabwe. Okay, Zimbabwe used to feed all of Southern Africa. Huge. It is the most fertile, you know, in Africa. It's the fertile soil. And it was a wonderful resource, very good standard of living, civil society. And, you know, Mugabe, after 10 years of being the grandfather of the country, he should have handed off power. And so it becomes a matter of governance that is not only a violent country, dirt poor country, it cannot feed itself. So you go from, because of the kind of government it is, I mean, we're going far afield out with political science, but because of the government it is, it's failed and it can't feed its own people and by itself. And there has to be ways where the powers or the governments can change, and then for sure the world community is going to come in with an overhanging deluge of aid and loans to replace that economy. That's for sure going to happen. So we have to blend in some way through the UN or some other institution, you know, to address these issues where you have statism that is the obstacle.
We can't be the world's policeman. We can't be the world's benefactor. We have to pick and choose, is what I hear you saying. When circumstances are right, we can give a hand. Take us in our civil war. We had to do some things ourselves, and other countries were waiting to see what was going to happen. There are places all over the world where we're misapplying military power. We can also misplace economic power or economic efforts. So how do we go about picking and choosing where we can do good, whether it's the economic bank, World Bank, or what have you? How do we produce jubilee, we Christians, this nation?
Jack had his hand up, and then Carl did, and Jody. You have something you want to get in, Jack?
I'm just thinking that within economics, it seems like greed is a human characteristic that motivates decisions like maybe the way a country decides to export rather than develop import. So it seems like you have to recognize the greed factor in economics, and then also I thought, what's the opposite of that? And it's more like a sharing value, as you were talking about the nations sharing together the wealth of the earth and managing it. with some kind of vision for the long-term good of of the earth. Well, we have laws in the United States that limit monopolies. There are some really big multinational corporations out there. We've talked a lot about states and nonprofits and the banks, but is it these multinational corporations that are actually coming in and building these infrastructures and doing the agribusiness? How much of this international development is, these corporations, I don't even know who they are, making a profit, and how much of it is, the local guys actually changing from growing their crops to growing coffee? I mean, how much of it is the international stuff? Maybe I'm not phrasing that well.
Yeah. There's big corporations, there's multinational corporations that do business in lots of different places. And they're in developing countries as well as in developed countries.
Are you asking, what a country owns from subsistence farming to model crops? Is it the farmer that's switching or the dole mining?
Right, that's what I'm getting at.
I think most of the kind of stuff is happening not because an international firm is coming and buying up all the land or it's because the society's changing internally the way it's trying to structure incentives.
So local farmers are still making a profit based on the switch to coffee?
I think what's happening is that the local farmers are switching to coffee, depleting their land. Then they're not making it, then they're not producing as much coffee as they once were. Then they can't make a living, they can't feed their family. So they sell their land to, Maxwell House or to Dole or Monsanto or whatever for pennies because they have to get out and then they own the city and then you just have.
But actually, with the Rwanda example, okay, they're not selling any more low-end commodity, they call them cherries. Okay. They are selling for $3.50 a pound direct. Okay, they form a farmers cooperative, they own it, they share it, and they borrow from the cooperative for next year's fertilizer and the washing stations and all this. So they today are much more profitable, and their lives are better, especially obviously after the Civil War. And they're paying for education, they're paying for clothes, and they're getting far more money than they ever did before. Mm-hmm. And it's partly because of the world economy that they're connected to, but it's also the removing of the state-owned marketing boards who were giving them, a nickel and 10 cents. It was the state that was the constraint, and that the profits would go to the state, to the elites in the state, and the urban areas. And to the detriment of the people farming. So the farmers and the farmers' cooperatives in Rwanda are doing far better today than they ever did. And so it's not all gloom and doom, but they're doing that. And actually, part of this, there was, I'm not going to talk about it this week, but Farm Aid, USAID, put in money to sort of kickstart these cooperatives, and they've been successful. So we are, in a way, this jubilee. There is a collective, and we're part of it. It's really messy, and but it's there, and it doesn't work all the time, and it gets ugly. But there is success, and I think it's a jubilee success when countries can step in and assist other countries through their difficult times.
So, do you think fair trade is a jubilee? Like proposal, because it seems like its aim is to try and limit the amount of taking advantage that can happen of the producers on the far end of the supply chain, and to try and give them, the growers or the producers, a better and more direct payment for the product they're producing. That's my sort of simpleton 101 sense.
Well, I think it's a good
thing.
That's
the idea.
That's the idea, and it's an efficient thing as well. It is. and they're doing bad.
Isn't listening to you describe the having to sell your land for pennies, then I think that the Genesis Leviticus models, is it the Egyptian model where everybody loses everything they've got and it's state ownership versus a Jubilee model in which everyone tries to kind of figure out that there's some shared wealth. And it seems
I really don't think that's what happens. In Africa, they have terrible trouble figuring out who owns what land. So there's not a market where you can buy anything for millions of dollars or pennies. Latin America has a colonial land system in which property rights to most land are ambiguous and still held in very large blocks. So there's nothing like a market to drive down the price of land than go buy up the pieces. And they're not even in the goblin world yet. Okay, and they're living in something like probably what really land ownership was in Israel in the 6th century BC, which is really muddled, not clear title for individuals to move things around. There was some kind of collective decisions that are happening, and that's hard for us to understand that in all places in the world you can't just buy and sell land, mm-hmm. right? But in most places in the world you can't buy and sell land. There's no way to do it. I mean, you can
survey.
But the structure of defining what you have is just not there. You know, there's not.
And
so you have different kinds of, when I was starting this afternoon, the Jubilee is working in a framework that is not like our framework. So when they say relieving debts and doing this redemption thing is a really important part of this kind of common ownership of land, which is kind of murky.
So
we have just a couple minutes, so a couple more comments from people, preferably if you haven't gotten in, but
a story. I came back from Nicaragua earlier this year and was hiking the next day and ran into a fellow, told him I'd been there. He said, oh, that's interesting. And he said, I started a family foundation to assist villages in Honduras, I think it was. He said, I partner with a branch from BYU and we go in. They figured out how to do this. We go into a school, and we start a garden there. Well, first they do blood tests, actually, and they check the climate in the soil, and they figure out what's needed in the people's systems. They figure out what will work in the area, and then they plant the garden, and they teach them how to do this. They work with the kids, and the moms get interested. And then as the garden flourishes, then the dads and the farmers around take an interest. And they start eating this produce and bringing it home, and then they suggest try this with a hatch of chickens. You take two of them and you raise them like we tell you, and you let the rest of them do it the usual way and see how things turn out. And 3 months later, we have two really healthy chickens and a few other ones left. And they work this process of education and testing for 3 to 5 years. And by the end of the 3 to 5 years, he says they've done this. I think they're on their third village or so. They have created a sustainable feeding the place. Their school's working a little better. More agriculture in the area. People are healthier. And the rest, the next village goes faster because they've been watching.
Yeah.
I said, so is this faith-based for you? And finally, he admitted he was LDS. He don't want to, but it sounded like a delightful thing to watch and a potentially really powerful tool. I don't see this happening.
And on the ground.
Three other quick things to think about. All of them immensely problematic and controversial, but are they related to Jubilee? I don't know. One is the second largest chunk of the Mexican GNP these days is remittances from the United States, contributions from families in the United States back to their families in villages in Mexico. This is some kind of a jubilee, some kind of a redistribution. And I get more excited about it when it's not just the individuals, but where chunks of the remittances get put into development investments in villages and regions in Mexico. But something's going on there that seems to me a little bit like Jubilee. this is maybe, the second one is even more controversial. How do you think about casinos on tribal lands as a as a jubilee mechanism? What's that about in terms of redistributing wealth?
And what's that have to do with cultural development and
self-image? Yeah, sometimes on some reservations they do that.
Right? Yeah.
And then third, you know, what do we do with Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and the growing philanthropic sector? And I, you know, the work I do, the philanthropic sector is much more interesting, flexible, still really problematic, but you can do more with it than you can with the World Bank.
Right, yeah, right.
In local development situations.
Good. Well, thanks everyone for coming and engaging the question. Was there someone over here I missed?
Oh, it's time to go, that's fine.
You're certain people who are welcome to stay and talk a little bit more, but I always want to end on time and give people who are ready to go an opportunity to go, but stay and throw out your comment if you'd like to, and if you want to stay and chat a little bit more, you can. But thanks to our two lead-off hitters.